disturbing data on an increasing obesity problem in young adults.
Does genetic testing improve the results of in vitro fertilization?
Does platelet-rich plasma help at all with knee osteoarthritis?
And the risk for stillbirth among women with COVID-19 at delivery hospitalization.
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, let's turn right to MMWR, Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report from the CDC, and this rather disturbing data on, wow, if you're pregnant, unvaccinated, and you get COVID-19, there's some daunting possibilities.
Right. So, Elizabeth, we've known for a while that pregnant women are at an increased risk for severe COVID-19-related illness. We know this is associated with the increased risk for adverse pregnancy outcomes and both complications in the mother and in the newborn. But whether it's associated with the increased risk of stillbirth really hasn't been well studied. That's what this study attempted to do. They looked between March of 2020 and September of 2021, and they used a large hospital-based administrative database that accounts for about 20% of the hospitalizations across the United States. They looked at women that delivered and those that had documented COVID-19 diagnosis. And what they discovered after looking at over 1.24 million deliveries, of which less than 2% of the mothers had COVID, is that the rate of stillbirth was about 0.6% in those that did not report a COVID infection, about 1.3% in those that had COVID infection. And then when they looked more specifically at those more likely to have the Delta variant, the risk was 2.7%. That is four times higher than women that didn't have COVID.
Clearly, one of the pieces of data that would be informative here would be timing of vaccination during pregnancy and what the impact of that might be on the rate of stillbirth.
It would be nice to know that. Unfortunately, as a result of how they gathered the data, we really don't know vaccination status. We really don't even know when the COVID infection occurred related to the delivery. We do know, however, that vaccinated mothers are less likely to develop COVID infections, less likely to develop severe COVID infections, that is hospitalizations and death. We don't know, however, how that affects stillbirths.
This reminds me of Lothi's many years ago when we were talking about flu vaccines in pregnant women and just how prudent they were. At the time, a lot of the authorities were saying, look, if you're planning on getting pregnant, just go ahead and get the flu vaccine. And that sounds like the best advice here also.
Right. I mean, everybody should be vaccinated. Unfortunately, there's a lot of misinformation, and there are women that are concerned about fertility being affected by COVID vaccination. That's not the case. So women that are considering pregnancy or are pregnant should certainly be vaccinated.
Let's turn to JAMA. This is a research letter with an unbelievably dramatic table, as well as a graph that I've got to tell people they really need to go and take a look at this. This is trends in obesity prevalence among adults aged 18 through 25 years, which they're calling this a critical period for the formation of lifelong habits and adult identity. And I don't think I've ever really heard this called out in this way before. So I thank the writers of this letter for informing me about that particular awareness. They looked at NHANES data and they drew it from 1976 through 2018. They limited their study population to non-pregnant emerging adults. That's what they call these people who are aged 18 to 25 of non-Hispanic Black or non-Hispanic White race with complete data. They defined BMI into four standard groups. A BMI less than 18.5 is underweight, normal 18.5 to 24.9, overweight 25 to 29.9, and obesity greater than or equal to 30. Interestingly, they didn't include morbid obesity in here, which we certainly are familiar with. And the really amazing and daunting statistic that I look at is when I look at the obesity category, I see that in 1976 through 1980, 6.2% of that population were obese. In 2017 to 2018, it's 32.7% of that population. We don't need to go over all of the many things that are really just not good about obesity. And I wonder, in this emerging adult population, what in the world are we going to do about it?
As you mentioned, over a 40-year period, it increased fivefold. And actually, when you look at the people that were considered to be normal weight back in 1976, that was about 70%, and that's decreased to about 38%.
You've got the king of the forest seat. What in the world can we do about this?
It's a multi-pronged approach. These people obviously have made it through school, so we need to do a better job of education, do a better job with nutrition, a better job with avoiding sedentary lifestyles, establishing healthy eating habits. I mean, the first thing to do, again, is broadcast this as widely as we can and say, this is a serious epidemic, a large epidemic, and it needs to be addressed.
Yeah, 1 in 3. I mean, that's amazing. Let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine. Many women, of course, experiencing IVF in vitro fertilization. Should you test these implantation embryos beforehand? Does that really help?
What women want to do is they want to select the best embryo because that optimizes the live birth rate. Typically, that's done by looking at the embryo, what's called the blastocyst. After the sperm has been injected into the egg and it begins to develop, that developing embryo in the early stages is called a blastocyst. There are certain characteristics that one looks at underneath a microscope that characterizes it as being healthy or not. But the question is, if you actually did genetic testing in addition to that, would that provide additional information that would make the live birth rate even better? They looked at 1,212 patients that were undergoing in vitro fertilization, and they were randomized to looking at 3 blastocysts and just looking at them underneath the microscope to determine whether they should be implanted. And then the other half of the women, they actually did genetic testing as well. And if the genetic testing showed that the chromosome count wasn't normal, they did not use that blastocyst. They went down the line and used a different one with the hopes that it would increase the live birth rate. And what they found is that in the women that had the genetic testing done, the live birth rate was 78%. And in the individual that had the conventional examination, it was 82%. And that is essentially no difference between the two.
And it's, of course, adds expense to the whole process, which is already pretty prohibitively expensive for many.
Right. That adds over $2,000 per examination. Now, a couple caveats. These are women that were relatively young. They otherwise had a good prognosis for a live birth.
So right now then, based on this study, would you say to women who are planning IVF that the need for this pre-implantation genetic testing is really not there?
And I think that's a good assessment or a good summary of it, Elizabeth. And by the way, there are other studies that have established the same thing. And you get a fair amount of information just by looking at the blastocysts underneath the microscope, what are called the morphologic features. So again, a well-done study because genetic testing is oftentimes offered in hopes of improving live birth rates. But I think this study and other ones as well have established that that's not the case.
Turning back then to JAMA, this is a procedure, this intra-articular platelet-rich plasma injection. Well, what is that stuff anyway? Platelet-rich plasma, I like to think of it as bright young thing, thought that this might be something that would be an improvement for folks who have osteoarthritis, which we know a very large number of people have. The authors remind us all that knee osteoarthritis affects approximately 260 million people worldwide, and it's a very common cause of disability. Of course, I have to note that some of this is due to obesity, so there might be some avoidance possible if you don't allow yourself to become obese. In any case, this injection of this platelet-rich plasma, or PRP, has been increasing all over the world, actually, and domestically, even though there's really no evidence that it's helpful. So this study was conducted in Australia. They enrolled 288 people who were 50 years of age or older with symptomatic medial knee osteoarthritis, and they followed them up over 12 months. They randomized them into 2 groups, one receiving 3 intra-articular injections of this PRP, and the other one with a placebo, saline. And then they said, okay, over 12 months, what's your overall change in knee pain? And then they also took a look at medial tibial cartilage volume with MRI. In both groups, everybody received all 3 injections. So that's a pretty great rate, I think, of completion. Among these patients, there is frankly no difference in the people who got the PRP injection. So it does not support this rampant use of this intervention.
Well, I've known a number of individuals that have gotten this. What happens is they take your blood out and they centrifuge it, take out the white cells and take that part of the plasma that has the platelets in it and re-inject it, your own blood, into the joint space. And the thought process behind it is that particular part of the blood has a lot of growth factors that are supposed to help generate blood vessels and supposed to generate cartilage. It's been used for not only for knee osteoarthritis, but also for ankle osteoarthritis, Achilles tendon problems. This study shows that it's not really very useful for knee osteoarthritis. Other studies looking at the ankle and the Achilles tendons also show that it really doesn't benefit as well. So although conceptually it was good, unfortunately its use has blossomed and there doesn't appear to be any benefit to its use.
Well, we really need to get this message out because I too have known numbers of people who have elected to undergo this procedure and there are risks associated with it.
Now, the interesting thing, if you talk to these individuals that have had it, the reason they go back for additional injections is because they feel better. Well, the interesting thing in this particular study is individuals that received PRP were compared to those that received placebo injections. And most of the placebo patients got better as well. Their symptoms got better and there was no additional loss in cartilage compared to PRP. So again, it talks to the placebo effect and the importance of doing randomized controlled trials where you compare the study drug or the study procedure to placebo.
I think that this also illustrates, for me at least, a struggle among people who have profound or even mild knee osteoarthritis, where they feel that it's limiting their range of activity, to find something that could actually be helpful. Because not everybody who has knee osteoarthritis is obese, and it is really disabling, and many people don't want to have joint replacement surgery.
Right, and joint replacement surgery is considered really the last therapy. That's when people find it just intolerable. As you mentioned, remaining active with non-weight-bearing exercise and weight reduction are really two of the things that we can do in terms of lifestyle changes. But obviously, there are anti-inflammatory medications that can be effective as well.
And many bright young things, actively investigating other things that might actually be helpful. On that hopeful note then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.